This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowane. Earlier this summer, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, released its revised flood maps for New Jersey. It shows which areas are in high-risk flood zones called V or velocity zones. The agency and its maps have been under attack from environmentalists who contend they minimize the threat of rising sea levels and from developers and homeowners who object to how it identifies flood-prone areas. Well, because of Sandy and predictions of future storms hitting New Jersey, accurate maps are keys to planning. If you have any questions or comments about maps in flood maps in New Jersey, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We asked Lisa Auermuller to join us on Radio Time. She's a marine scientist at Rutgers University's Jacques Cousteau National Estuary Research Reserve that's in Tuckerton, New Jersey, working on New Jersey coastal communities to understand and plan for risk. I should add that the reserve was an academic partner with FEMA. And Lisa, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be with you.
Well, let's start with some really basic questions. What's a floodplain map?
So a floodplain map, as produced by FEMA, helps homeowners and the federal government understand where risky spots are. And then from the federal government side, it helps jurisdict where the federal flood insurance program is located and who pays what rates under that program.
And how is that determined? Is it a matter of using, you know, satellite systems, or is it a matter of walking the state and determining these flood zones?
So actually a little bit of both. There are very high-powered data sets that form the baseline for how the maps are created, especially these newer maps that we have here in New Jersey now. So those really defined maps form the baseline. They then run some floodplain models over the top of them. And then the FEMA consultants will go out later and do some spot checking of those maps to make sure that what the models are showing through the computers holds up when they take that model out to the ground as well. So I think it's a little bit of both.
And when they talk about a V or velocity zone, what does that mean to be in a high-risk flood zone?
So a V zone specifically means that during the time of storms, you could have at least 3-foot waves pounding against your building. Wow. I mean, you could always have more, but you would need to be built for construction standards that would be able to withstand at least those 3-foot waves. And then in turn on the flood insurance rate side, it means that you are in a very high risk area and therefore your rate will likely be higher than other zones to accommodate that riskiness.
Well, and looking at the New Jersey coastline, which areas are called velocity zones or V-zones?
So some of the areas directly along the coastline, the areas that have a high amount of fetch where water can really pick up some energy by wind blowing over it to create large waves, those are the areas that are going to be put in the most risky zones. Some of our back bay areas that are tucked into lagoonal systems, those are been designated primarily in A zones, which is still a coastal zone, but would see less wave energy predicted through these models.
And so what counties or even what communities are we talking about then?
All of New Jersey has a variety of zones in them. So all up and down the coast, you're going to have a mixed bag of A and V zones, and then construction zones that are even less risky than that behind that.
Now, there were advisory maps that came out this past winter, and then we have these other maps. Help us understand or reconcile these two mapping processes.
Sure. It was a really confusing time
Yes.
in New Jersey, actually. So FEMA, for a few years now in Region 2, which is the region New Jersey falls under, has been undergoing a remapping process, and it's a map modernization process. So they knew that the old maps were created in the 80s. The technology has significantly improved since then. So they wanted to create maps that were much more actuarial to the risk that we have here in the state now. So they were already undergoing a remapping process. We then got hit by mm-hmm. Superstorm Sandy at the end of October. During that time, the state wanted to put out some recommendations about rebuilding. And because FEMA was already undergoing some of the modeling but hadn't completely finished it, they decided to put out the advisory maps, which took into account some of the modeling for the new final maps, but didn't take into account all the modeling. So many, many, many properties got put into V-zones, and many people were up in arms that their building restrictions would be much higher and much more costly because they would have to build to these construction standards of being in a V-zone. Ultimately, FEMA has now come out with the preliminary maps kind of on schedule with the original remapping process started 2 years ago, and many of those homes put in V-zones back during the advisory maps have since been taken out and are really back into A-zones. And people, homeowners and community leaders are feeling much happier about the number of homes no longer in V-zones and put into A-zones now.
And it looks like the number of V-zones were pretty dramatically reduced from these preliminary maps to the ones that were released earlier in the summer.
In some areas, significantly, like as many as 75 to 80% of the homes came out of a V-zone and were put into A-zone or something less than that.
And was that just because there was more information? I know there was a rush to try to figure out what to do after Sandy, but it was just more data, more information to have more accurate floodplain or flood zone planning?
So I think, to put it simply, yes,
sure.
There was more information. One specific part of the model called overland wave modeling was not taken into account when the advisory maps mm-hmm. came out. So that kind of model doesn't take into account the fact that structures might be in the water's path and actually slow the water down. Once they put those structures and ran that model with the overland wave factored in and water started slowing down in their model, the preliminary maps now show that fewer structures are actually going to take on the full brunt of force of a 3-foot wave.
I think we all remember some of those protest signs, Stop FEMA Now.
Yeah, that was that. I don't know that that's completely over, but it certainly reached a peak when those advisory maps came out.
And the idea, I mean, obviously, if you find yourself in one of these high-risk areas, that can mean a lot of money for insurance or a lot of extra money for rebuilding, yes?
It sure can. It can mean a lot of upfront costs now. I do like to suggest to people I work with coastal communities to understand risk both now and into the future. And I do like to remind the communities that the FEMA maps, although they're much better than they were in the 80s and they use a lot better technology, they are only based on current information and past information. So it's sort of like driving down the road and looking in the rearview mirror. They do not take into account any future storminess or effects we're going to see with climate change, such as sea level rise heights. And when you factor those things in, some of even the highest risk areas now, those V zones, still won't be built strong enough for the future storms that are predicted.
So you really end up planning for the storm that just happened?
Exactly.
Which is sort of forward and backward at the same time.
Yeah, the FEMA maps, because they're a regulatory product and the flood insurance rate program is defined based on what those maps say, they currently cannot take into account future conditions. No, there are some, as you say, environmental groups and advocacy groups who are pushing to allow regulatorily the future conditions to be included to actually show what the risk might look like in the future.
Because some were critical, saying that these maps do not take into account that there is this threat of sea level rise, especially in a place like New Jersey.
Those groups are correct. The maps mm-hmm. do not take into account. In New Jersey, we do have home rule. So each community could take it upon themselves to add freeboard, which means an additional foot of building height as a requirement in local regulations to encourage homeowners to build higher. The state itself, as a statewide requirement, has already added a foot of freeboard to all the FEMA maps. But we, as a science-based organization, know that a foot might not be enough into the future and would potentially recommend even going quite a bit higher.
How much higher?
Well, I mean, in some places you have height restrictions that are going to limit you from how high you can go, but going, 3-4 feet higher will only make you that much safer. The real problem is going to be that the houses may be really high, but the roadways to get in and out of those houses during a storm may still be underwater. And that's something that towns need to consider as well.
Now, you're a marine scientist. Have you seen measurable sea rise in New Jersey, on the coast of New Jersey?
We absolutely have. You can look at tide gauge data in Atlantic City, at Sandy Hook, along the Delaware Bayshore, and all of those tide gauges will show a statistically significant increase in tidal height over the past 100 years and more. And my scientist colleagues will tell me that that line is linear now, and we expect it to continue exponentially into the future, meaning that the rate will only continue to increase over time.
And how much did Superstorm Sandy then just, you know, change how the mapping was taking place in New Jersey?
For FEMA, it didn't change the mapping process other than the fact that they did put out these advisory maps, which the only ever other time that was ever done was after Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast. So that's not a process that FEMA does very often, and hindsight being 2020, they may think about how they do it the next time around. But the storm itself did not change the mapping process. In fact, in the models that they used to calculate the flood zones on the maps, Sandy is not really factored in to those models because those models are an average of storms over many, many years, and Sandy, you know, would just fit in with that average.
But I would think with any kind of FEMA map anywhere, flood map, you're dealing with a dynamic environment, and an environment that is not static.
You sure are. That's true. And FEMA maps are not updated all the time. 30-plus years went between the last maps and these new maps that are out. So that is why when I do the work I do, I encourage communities to think about the dynamic nature of the coast, to take into account climate change, to think about the options they have for adaptation, and to leave room for the coast to do what it wants to do naturally.
And do you find people's opinions have changed on those particular issues as a result of Sandy and the devastation of Sandy?
I think the conversations have changed. I think people are more aware of the value of the dune system, wide beaches, the importance of a marsh being a natural barrier and to help protect with storms. Unfortunately, the pace of rebuilding along our state happened really quickly, and when you take the science out and you put the emotions in, you can understand why that happened. But I think the conversations are happening. We're not seeing a ton on the ground yet in terms of acknowledging the fact that we are building in a really risky area, but hopefully through the work that we do here at the Reserve and that my colleagues are doing around the state, we can help people understand that risk and think about resiliency in a way that gives them some ideas of what they can do next.
What I hear you saying, we're almost out of time, is that some people have rebuilt exactly the way what they had before Sandy and might be at risk?
I think that we've seen a lot of that along the coast, and putting things back just the way they were, they got destroyed one time. We know storminess is going to increase and intensity is going to increase, and it does make you question why some of those decisions were made.
Well, on that note, Lisa Auermuller, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. She's a marine scientist at Rutgers University's Jacques Cousteau Reserve. We'll be talking more about the New Jersey coastline post-Sandy and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The WHYY Connections Festival is back with a day of free live music featuring They Might Be Giants, Ben Queller, and more. Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. The WHYY Connections Festival is free for everyone, and WHYY members and sustainers get exclusive access to the member oasis tent all day long. They Might Be Giants and more Saturday, September 7th at the Great Plaza. For a full lineup and to register, visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
August Wilson's American Century Cycle includes some of his most famous plays.
It is my job. It is my responsibility. You understand that? A man's got to take care of his family.
Now the entire 10-play series is being recorded for the first time. We'll hear more about the project from actress Felicia Rashad and director Kenny Leon next time on Tell Me More.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a look at Egypt with New York Times reporter David Kirkpatrick and treehouses for adults. There is satellite TV, AC, a full kitchen, and 300 square feet of living space 30 feet above the ground.
It's got the comforts of home. It is so cozy. It smells good. It's like we're just here to find peace.
That is next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowain here on WHYY in Philadelphia. On Monday, the Hurricane Sandy Rebuilding Task Force released its report with 69 recommendations about how New Jersey can rebuild after last fall's storm devastation. President Obama called for the creation of the task force, which was headed up, or is headed up, I should say, by HUD Secretary Sean Donovan. We asked Aaron O'Neill to join us on Radio Times, a reporter for the Newark Star-Ledger Shore Bureau. And Aaron O'Neill, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, especially our New Jersey listeners, if you live there, have a house there, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Aaron, who else served on this task force besides HUD Secretary Sean Donovan?
Well, it was a large group of federal officials, state officials, and local officials. So they got input from shore mayors, the governors of both states, and also federal officials.
And the idea was recommendations for what, moving forward to hopefully prevent some of the problems that happened as a result of Sandy?
Yeah, they're looking how best to rebuild the shore area after Sandy. One, in terms of the massive Sandy aid package, there's $50 billion that are going to the areas impacted by the storm. And President Obama tasked this task force with figuring out how best to put that money into the system. But they're also looking at this on a national level. Right. So they hope that this strategy applies to the areas impacted by Sandy, but they also hope going forward that it will serve as a blueprint for nationwide.
And I do want to talk about all of that, but it, already rebuilding has gone on in New Jersey since the devastation of Sandy. So does that rebuilding, is that sort of part of this recommendation?
Well, they don't have, I mean, for things that have already been rebuilt, they
right.
have been rebuilt. There's not really too much that they can do with that. This is really going forward, and there's going to be large infrastructure projects coming out of the Sandy aid package, so it really more applies to those items.
Now, as you said, the $50 billion earmarked for Sandy reconstruction, and how much of that has been spent? Do you know, Aaron?
It's only a small portion so far. I know there's been, in terms of the CDBG grants, $1.83 billion has been earmarked for New Jersey. Donovan said that the next allotment of that aid should be announced in the coming weeks for New Jersey.
And we're talking about 69 recommendations. What's on the top of that list?
Well, the report is really a wide-ranging report, but I'd say the theme that plays throughout the entire thing is that climate change and sea level rise are something that we have to deal with moving forward. And so we need to build higher and we need to build stronger in order to strengthen ourselves against the next storm.
And the idea of sea level rise, I was talking with our first guest who's a marine scientist, measurable when it comes to the state of New Jersey, yes?
According to the report and according to scientists, yes.
And are they in a predicting mood? Have they been able to sort of predict how that is going moving forward, sea level rise?
I mean, from the report, they expect it to continue to rise, which is one of the reasons, one of the first recommendations in the report is to provide a tool for planners and engineers going forward that shows sea level rise and how it will play out on the shore in the next 100 years. So as we're considering how to rebuild and how best to rebuild, they can look at this map and see what the floodplain is going to be 100 years from now.
And what are some of the most vulnerable parts of New Jersey? I'm sure you're very familiar with the shoreline.
I mean, I'd say up and down the coast, there's risk throughout. I mean, there's some areas that have historically have flooding problems, such as Seabright in Monmouth County. But there's issues up and down the shore.
And one thing that we learned, and we did several shows about this, about the role that the dunes did play in protecting some or many of the communities along the New Jersey shore.
Yeah, if you talk to community members in place that did have engineered dune systems, they say that those dunes saved their town. And it's become even more important for people in Back Bay areas, such as Brick and Tom's River, that live in kind of these lagoon communities in the Back Bays. they say if they had the dunes on the barrier islands, that their towns would have been saved because they wouldn't have had the breaches in the island that had the water overflow and then caused the flooding back there.
And we know that the dunes, at least in some communities, have been controversial, that some people don't want a gigantic dune in front of their house ruining their lovely view of the ocean.
Yeah, there's a mixture of concerns, and towns are still trying to get the easements that are necessary in order for the Army Corps of Engineers to come in and build dune systems. Manaloking is having a problem getting the easements, and they're considering using eminent domain in order to get them. It's both an issue of view, some homeowners have said, but also the giving that piece of land and giving the federal government a right to come onto that piece of land.
Part of these recommendations calling for a regional approach to rebuilding and regional cooperation. Can you talk a bit about that and even about how there might be some pushback from some communities that you know, don't want to necessarily think about what they do and how it might affect their neighbors?
Yeah, I mean, this is specifically, the report goes into how New Jersey faces this problem. It's been a problem in the state forever. I mean, we have 565 municipalities. According to the report, 136 took the brunt of Sandy, and 37 municipalities suffered extensive damage. If you look at the shoreline, just in the barrier island in northern Ocean County, there's several municipalities right there. There's Point Pleasant Beach, Bayhead, Manaloking, Toms River, Brick, Seaside Heights, Seaside Park. So in terms of coordinating a flood plan and how to move forward with this, having a regional plan is very important, according to the report. And there's several ways they're trying to push that, because if someone puts a seawall up in their town, the fear is that, okay, well, the ocean water may get pushed away from that town, but it's going to make it even worse in the town to the south or the town to the north. And I talked to the mayor of Seabright, who said that they have plans for how they hope to deal with flooding, but they don't want to move forward if it's going to affect someone upriver, if it's going to affect someone downriver. So they're hoping that even though there is this history and ingrained home rule in New Jersey, that from this storm there'll be a push for more regional cooperation.
And does this plan, does it offer advice about how to get regions to cooperate with each other?
There's a couple things in the report. There's something called the New Jersey Resiliency Partnerships, which is a voluntary association, and it's a new model where groups of adjacent towns with common flood risk and recovery challenges are going to get together to try to work with one another in order to secure resources instead of competing with one another to try to get these limited funds that are out there.
And that's Erin O'Neill. She's a reporter with the Newark Star-Ledger Shore Bureau. And we're talking about the Hurricane Sandy Rebuilding Task Force just released its report, including 69 recommendations about how New Jersey can rebuild after last fall's storm devastation and lessons that can be applied to other parts of the country as well. And again, we'd love to hear from our New Jersey listeners. If you were affected by Sandy, what advice would you have? What recommendations would you have? And if you have read some of these recommendations, we'll be curious about your response as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What about money? Now, money has been earmarked for some of this rebuilding. There's federal money, there's state money, I guess there's local money as well. But how much are our money problems or access to money just affecting however New Jersey is rebuilding from Sandy?
Well, capacity in general, whether it's money, people, or just getting access to resources, has definitely been an issue for some of these small towns. And it's addressed in this report where they recommend that more capacity is built out, because some of these small towns have either had, you know, part-time engineers or part-time planners, and that's worked for them in the past. But now when you're dealing with a whole community that needs to get built out again, that's not going to work now. And hiring really isn't an option because they would have to raise taxes, and this is possibly the worst time to raise taxes in these communities.
You had an interesting story about some of the small builders in New Jersey who, you know, were interested in some of the reconstruction programs, but found they weren't necessarily a good fit. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, this is the one of the big grant programs that's running throughout the state, the Reconstruction, Rehabilitation, Elevation, Mitigation Grant Program. And it offers homeowners up to $150,000 to rebuild their homes from the storm. But as a way to control the money and not to repeat some of the mistakes that were made after Katrina, the state has tight control over which contractors are assigned, and you have to qualify for a pool of contractors in order to participate in the program, and then the state assigns, basically the state assigns a contractor to a homeowner. But there's bonding requirements, there are, and time limits that some of these small builders just don't think that they can meet, and so it's definitely been an issue for them.
Too much paperwork, and it sounded like it even with that kind of money may not be worth it to them to do some of this rebuilding?
Yeah, I mean, they need to, a lot of the money has to be put up front and then they're paid back throughout. And for some smaller builders, it's just not something that they can afford to do.
These recommendations also talked about the energy supply, the electricity grid. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, after Sandy, there were several issues in terms of, I mean, over more than 9 million people throughout the region were without power, some for, like, more than a week. And cell phone service was spotty, if not available at all in some areas. So there's a push in this report to find ways to improve that. There's also a push to find ways to improve the fuel supply so that we don't have the same problems in terms of lines wrapping around the block with people holding 5-gallon buckets trying to get gas in order to power generators.
And how is this? I mean, the summer isn't over yet, but how has the summer been for New Jersey?
It depends who you talk to, but most business owners are saying that it's not been a great summer. I did a story about business on the Seaside Heights Boardwalk. I mean, they pushed really hard, and there was a lot of tension around that town to build the boardwalk back and get it back where it was. They were able to open most stuff by Memorial Day and continued building back. Some of the rides are now back open. But they say the people just aren't there. And a lot of that is attributed to second homeowners who haven't been able to rebuild their homes, who would be the people that are going out to the restaurants and spending money locally. And those second homeowners aren't eligible for any of the funding through the CDBG block grants. It's only available to primary homeowners.
I remember doing some shows and talking with some mayors in New Jersey, and their concern, this was early on, that all the pictures and the bad news about New Jersey would scare people away. Do you think that happened? I know that was quite a while ago, but nonetheless, do you think that was a factor?
Well, I can just say after the story about Seaside Heights ran, I received an email from an individual who said he was considering coming down to the Jersey Shore, and he was looking online, and he saw all these stories about the devastation and decided instead to go to a lake in North Jersey. So I think it still does have an effect. I mean, there are many spots along the Jersey Shore that either weren't affected, specifically south of Atlantic City, and there are areas that are built back, but I think getting that word out has been difficult.
And we know that New Jersey depends on tourism, and that's so much a part of helping New Jersey and its budget.
Definitely.
You also had a story about a home buyer program for low and moderate income families maybe buying in some of these storm-damaged counties. Again, help us understand what that program is about.
This is a state-run grant program that's offering interest-free, forgivable mortgage loans for individuals. They have to meet a certain income requirement, and they also have their credit score has to be, I believe it's 620. And if they are looking to buy a house in one of the 9 counties most impacted by Sandy, they can apply for this loan. And if they live in the house for up to 5 years as their primary residence, it will then be forgiven. Right. And it's a push, really, to get renters who are looking to move into to primary residence, move into home ownership, because renting has been such a problem, specifically in Ocean County and Monmouth County after the storm. renters that were pushed out of their homes were competing with homeowners that were pushed out of their homes in order to find rental properties. And there are stories of price gouging and other issues with those rental properties.
And even going back to this report, I mean, it sounds like if there's a major message from this report for New Jersey and perhaps for other parts of the country as well, is that there are going to be more storms like Sandy and are going to have the potential to have, if not as much devastation, maybe even more devastation as Sandy looking ahead in this century.
I mean, the report is clear in saying that we should be preparing for more intense storms, that the data shows that climate is changing, and that we need to prepare for that.
And I'm just curious about how, when you talk to people who have homes or live on the New Jersey shore, they're taking these warnings seriously? Has Sandy, I guess, changed the conversation in New Jersey?
I think it has to some extent. I mean, there's still people who have built their homes back the way they were before and say they're willing to take the risk and that they're not concerned. But you talk to other people who are taking this very seriously. They never saw water to the height it was during Sandy, and they hope to never see it again, but they want to prepare for it.
And have you been covering the New Jersey shore for some time now, Erin?
I've been covering Sandy recovery since the storm hit, really. Mm-hmm. But I grew up on the Jersey shore, so it's my home.
It's your home. And were you hit by Sandy? I'm just curious.
No, I wasn't. I have family in Seattle City that had some flooding issues, but it was mostly in basements and issues like that.
So what do you think of the lessons from Sandy? And obviously this is what this rebuilding task force was all about.
I mean, according to the task force report, I just think that it shows you need to, if you do build higher, you can prepare yourself for storms like these, and you can see it in the areas where there was dunes and where people raised their homes on pilings, that some of those structures survived where others did not.
And the idea is, if you had a house there that was or is vulnerable, to put it on stilts or in some way get it off the ground.
That's one of the recommendations, definitely in the report, and what FEMA is calling for in its flood maps.
Right, and we were talking actually earlier about the flood maps, thinking the possibility of 1 to 2, maybe even 3 feet of sea level rise?
If that's what the sea level rise tool says.
Well, on that note, Erin O'Neill, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. She's a reporter with the Newark Star-Ledger Shore Bureau and joined us as we were talking about the Hurricane Sandy Rebuilding Task Force. Just came out with 69 recommendations earlier this week. We also spoke with marine scientist Lisa Auermuller talking about some of these flood maps. And we'll be talking with Brian Walsh about some international studies that also have essentially kind of the same message. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
This week in This American Life, a sheriff in California has a problem. His deputies spend too much time busting small-scale pot farmers. So he devises a plan. He'll let the farmers grow their pot as long as they register with the sheriff. Pretty good, right? Bust the big guys instead? So what did his deputies think?
The sheriff is off his rocker.
Stories of people who are just trying to help this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
They say you're all corrupt. Mexican police, you all take bribes.
Not all of us.
In the new FX series, The Bridge, Damian Bachir plays a Mexican detective working a homicide case with El Paso cops on the Texas-Mexican border. On the next Fresh Air, he'll talk about that role and playing a drug lord on the Showtime series Weeds and Fidel Castro in the film Che. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Three bullets that nearly took a life but did not change a mind.
The kids who approached us were doing exactly what my friend and I were doing. I don't think the fact that they were black and wearing hoodies would have been appropriate grounds for a police officer to stop them and frisk them.
A shooting victim who says that indiscriminate stop and frisk programs make society less safe. Next time on The Takeaway from Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. A draft of the UN International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was leaked earlier this week. It said that if it was even more certain that human behavior was implicated in global warming and predicted that seas could rise by 3 feet by the end of the century if something wasn't done to reduce CO2 emissions. We asked Brian Walsh to join us. He's Times International Senior Editor and a blogger for Times Ecocentric blog. And Brian Walsh, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Were you surprised, Brian, by that conclusion?
Not really. I mean, you know, essentially what the IPCC is saying, yes, here is just sort of upping the level of certainty that they had in the last report. I mean, at this point, when it comes to what we think of as the basics of climate science, which is that the climate is warming and that human man-made carbon emissions are really the main driver behind that warming, I mean, that's extremely certain. I mean, it's almost unequivocal at this point, so that's not too surprising. The more important parts of the study really in the draft are going to be, you know, how much is it going to warm, what impact will it have on sea level, what impact will it have on extreme weather and hurricanes. Those are the areas that, you know, really matter when it comes to trying to figure out what to do about climate change. And while there's a lot of certainty there, there's a lot more variety, a lot more, I think, science that still has to be done to sort of figure out exactly what impacts climate change will have.
Well, it's interesting to talk about certainty because the previous report saying 90% and this one saying 95%. So a 5% increase in certainty is a big deal?
I mean, within the bounds of the IPCC, it's a big deal. You know, I mean, you have to understand that this is a report that takes 5 years to draft. It's talking about thousands of scientists working on their own time with this. And then it's actually going to go through a political review later next month as well. So although that might not seem like a big change, I mean, what that's saying in very conservative IPCC language, I mean, the IPCC really looks for the most consensus they can. They're really a conservative body. It's really just saying that at this point, look, we know that this is happening. This is real. Now we have to move on to the question of what to do about it.
Well, in fact, some of your reporting are about some of these other organizations essentially reaching the same conclusion.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you'll see different varieties. And certainly when you talk to individual climate scientists who are creating the research, the studies that go into the IPCC, many of them are, you know, they're even more worried than you might hear coming out of the IPCC. Mm-hmm. They worry about sea level rise that could be in excess of that, I think, 16 to 24 inches that the IPCC draft report has said so far. I mean, they're seeing more like 3, 4, 5, 6 feet, and that can make a big difference when it comes to storm surges. And we saw here in New York, where I live, you know, just the small amount of sea level rise we've experienced so far can take a storm like Sandy and make it that much worse. So it's, you know, when you talk to those individual scientists, they're, you know, often very concerned and willing to go a little further out on the limb than I think the IPCC will.
I still have that image in my head of the water just flooding into a subway stop or a subway in Manhattan where you are.
Exactly. I mean, it really just ruined the subway system. I mean, we lost power for millions of people. I mean, half of Manhattan was dark for several days after Sandy. And, you know, I mean, the storms like that will happen. And Sandy, you know, it's not clear how much impact climate change may or may not have had on a storm like that. And what that says is that when you put people into harm's way, with New York City and Miami and New Orleans, and a storm does come, it will make the damage will be huge. Now, the last thing you want to do is then amplify that damage by allowing the climate to continue to warm, seas to continue to rise. That'll make, you know, a bad storm even worse.
Well, and as you have written and others, more and more people are moving to coastlines. We've got millions of people in this country who live in Manhattan and New Orleans and other coastal cities.
Absolutely. I mean, you have something like 87 million people now live along the coast in the United States. That's up from 40 million just a few decades ago. You know, that's where people want to live. That's where the most valuable property is. So that means, you know, we're going to have, I think, very damaging storms in the future, almost no matter what happens, simply because we're putting more people, more property in harm's way. And what that really says is that you need, beyond, of course, dealing with carbon emissions and trying to sort of blunt climate change as best you can, you also need to build in flood protections for cities. I mean, New York really didn't have much, and it paid the price. You have Mayor Bloomberg now. He has a $20 billion plan to help storm-proof the city as much as possible. Of course, it's going to be the next mayor of New York that's going to actually have to carry that out, and that's a lot of money as well.
Well, what is it? Building dikes, building dunes, of various ways of just sort of, and essentially building walls against some of these rising seas?
Exactly. I mean, you can look at what the Netherlands has done. Obviously, a country that's very accustomed to flooding has a lot of experience with that in the past. In cities like Rotterdam, you have massive seawalls that really hold back those rising seas, that really defend those cities against that kind of storm. And that's what we'll need to do. I mean, the Bloomberg plan has some seawalls. That'll be part of it. But also there are smaller things you can do, more softer changes that can be made. You can help sort of protect wetlands around coasts. That can make a big difference because those areas can actually absorb storm surges. That's important. Some of it comes down to social changes. I mean, helping people be better prepared. It also comes down to hardening the power grid so you're less likely to lose electricity in the aftermath of a big storm. All of this really will pay off in the future, but it also does involve a lot of investment up front.
And that's Brian Walsh, a Time International senior editor, blogger for Time's ecocentric blog, I should say. We're talking about some reports, including one by the IPCC, talking about sea level rise and global warming. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Brian, I don't even know how to think about a sea level rise of 3 feet. I realize when you add surges and things like that, it becomes pretty catastrophic. But I know sea level rise has been going up incrementally, but 3 to 6 feet is just sort of hard to imagine what the world would look like.
I mean, it is hard to imagine because on one hand, it doesn't sound like all that much. I mean, the tides will change seas, from any given day quite a lot. But what's really important, it's not as if you're going to see cities like New York or Miami buried literally underwater. That's not going to happen for the foreseeable future. But what that does is, imagine it's like you have a bucket of water. Now, when a storm comes, sort of pushes that water up and over, that's when we get coastal flooding like we saw with Sandy. Now, with sea level rise, if you add that 3 feet, say, suddenly that water in that bucket is already higher. So when that storm comes along, and it might be even stronger because of climate change, that much more water gets pushed over, you're that much more vulnerable, and that makes those catastrophic events all the worse.
And we know some cities are sinking.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's another part of it as well. I mean, if you put a city on a delta, you'd actually lose land. Shanghai over in China, one of the fastest growing cities in the world, is built in a delta. It's actually sinking as well. So then you have a double whammy, essentially. You have the impact of rising seas, and then you actually have the city itself sinking. And that really would concern me. I mean, when it comes to, there was a report actually that came out from Nature Climate Change earlier this week that looked at all the cities that are most vulnerable to flooding. And you definitely have American cities up there, but the ones they're really worried about are the big mega cities in developing nations, cities like Guangzhou in China, Bombay in India, because there you have a lot of people in harm's way, but you also have, you don't have the same resources necessarily to deal with those kind of problems. And that's where we're likely to see the really massive damage in the future if something comes and hits those cities.
I'm sure someone listening to us is just, tearing their hair out saying it's lost. This is it. This is the end of life as we know it. True, not true?
Well, no, it's not the end of life as we know it. I mean, we can adjust, we can adapt. I mean, that's the important thing to take away from this. So there's really two things we can do. One, we can reduce carbon emissions over time. That's very important to kind of mitigate the worst climate damage we might otherwise face. But there's also adaptation that has to happen. I mean, when we talk about flood-proofing cities, that's a big part of it. A city like New Orleans already has flood defenses. Obviously, in Katrina, they proved to be not accessible, but you can do things, and we shouldn't just give up, and that would be the mistake, especially when you consider the fact that these cities are not going to go away. New York is not going to move away from the coast. Mayor Bloomberg's been very clear about that. So that's why you have to take these storms and take climate change very seriously, adapt now, and mitigate for the future.
Let me see what looks like Matthew from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. And Matthew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just want to emphasize that we've had a scientific consensus for so long about the effects that keep getting worse and worse, and it really is a political problem of how just to go about this. It seems like everyone's kind of twiddling their thumbs, even in the face of science that says we need to do something about it, and they just don't seem to be willing to kind of make any kind of international concessions with the Kyoto Protocol and all these kinds of different international panels to, affect some kind of change in this regard.
Well, there's even national lack of consensus. Do you want to speak to that, Brian?
It's absolutely true. You know, I mean, in many ways, this question has gone beyond science. I mean, science is still extremely important to figure out the exact local impacts of climate change to give us, you know, a better diagnosis. But the reality is there's been consensus on this issue for a long time, and it is now a political question. And, you know, I wouldn't completely, you know, there are things that are being done. You know, I mean, carbon emissions in the United States have actually have recently dropped, thanks partially both to renewable energy and to the use of cleaner natural gas. But, you know, it's going to take a big international effort, you know, and that means both in terms of trying to figure out ways to reduce carbon emissions, and we still have that international negotiation process going along, not that well, but it is happening. Mm-hmm. But also it's going to take sort of maybe aid to countries that need it to better adapt to climate change, and a lot of this will come down, hopefully, to economic growth. I mean, it's better to be a richer nation when you're dealing with these kind of problems than a poorer one, but it's definitely the case that at this point, you know, it's really the politicians, not so much the scientists, who need to act.
Matthew, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But Brian, even looking at our own Congress, does that give you confidence that this country can deal with this?
Well, it's rare to look at Congress today and have any confidence, really.
Yeah, that was kind of a softball question, but no, go ahead.
Problem right now. But it's, you know, climate change is a very hard problem to deal with. I mean, we can see we're not very good at dealing with problems of the future, and, you know, climate change is just one of many that we face. And certainly the rise of just this sort of knee-jerk denialism on the part of, you know, really most of the Republican Party has made it very hard to deal with this. And, you know, I honestly don't know how that will change. I mean, until you can have, you know, a Republican candidate for president and Republican senators and representatives saying, all right, we accept this is a problem, step one, you have to accept it, then we can talk about how to deal with it. And we seem now, politically at least, to have gone backwards on this. I mean, in 2008, you had both John McCain and Barack Obama saying climate change is real, we need to do something about it. 2012, that was not the case. So until that changes, we're, as a nation, are going to be very hampered in dealing with this.
I've had guests say on this show that because we can't sort of see it the way we can see smog and pollution, that makes it harder for people to understand what climate change is about.
I mean, that's very true. You know, it took us a long time, frankly, to deal with even those more sort of standard pollution issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, bad water, bad air. But we have managed to do that. But the problem with climate change is that it's still, you know, mostly in the future. You know, the effects that we've seen so far, you know, the closer you get to the present, the harder it is to lock on certain events. Were they caused by climate change? So we know with a lot of scientific certainty that this is coming, but because we don't see it, because we can put it out decades into the future still, you know, it's something that's very easy mm-hmm. to ignore or just deny altogether.
And, worryingly, even if we were to stop CO2 emissions today, we would still see growing temperatures just because of the way climate works, right?
Exactly. I mean, carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for centuries, so that's absolutely true. If somehow, some way, we were able to completely stop all carbon emissions this day, we'd still see, you know, a significant amount of warming going into the future. And that's tough because that means that even if we do get our act together and really do begin to reduce carbon emissions, we won't be able to head off all that warming. You know, it will make a big difference, and certainly our grandchildren and great-grandchildren would thank us, but, you know, we're going to have to deal with this situation for a long time, certainly for all our lifetimes, regardless of what we do now.
And I often think that people confuse weather and climate. It's been, for us here in Philadelphia, it hasn't been the extreme summer weather that we've had in years past, and I've heard people saying, maybe climate change isn't such a problem after all.
Right. I mean, that's exactly the case. And just because the climate will change doesn't mean there won't be cool days sometimes. It doesn't mean there won't be snow occasionally. Mm-hmm. You have to look at climate sort of as the average of all the weather. You know, weather is what's going to happen to you tomorrow. Climate is what is likely to happen in the future. But that, again, is sort of one more thing that makes this hard to deal with, because all you need really is a shift in weather for a little while, and you start to lose that belief in climate change. I mean, you can actually look at polls, and in the aftermath of major events, droughts, heat waves, big storms, you see belief in climate change go up. And then, you know, when you have a run of normal weather, it tends to go down.
And what's been the hot part of the world so far this year? Do you know?
I mean, Northeast Asia has been incredibly hot. I mean, mm-hmm. you're dealing with a record-breaking heat wave in cities like Shanghai and countries like Japan, in Southeast Asia and Seoul. I mean, it's been truly brutal, you know, and that can happen at the same time that, as you point out, here on the East Coast, you know, July was not that great, but it's been actually pretty cool so far in August. So that's the uneven way we're likely to see that, and that's another way, again, that makes it sort of hard to build that public consensus because, mm-hmm. you know, in a country as big as the United States, in any given day, someone may be suffering the effects of, you know, a heat wave or drought. Someone else might be having actually fairly cool weather, so it's hard to really see it all at once happening.
And in terms of fixes, do you see then technological fixes, the idea of more efficiency of products, things like that, that all that can have an effect on climate change?
It's going to have an effect. I mean, what we're going to need to do is figure out ways to produce electricity that does not use carbon, you know. So that's going to mean renewable energy, solar, wind. It's going to mean possibly nuclear as well. It's going to mean much better efficiency, so you're not wasting as much energy and carbon along the way. And it's going to mean technological change as well, because, you know, while, you know, we've seen solar and wind make a difference right now, it does need to get less expensive. The technology does need to improve. Efficiency needs to improve. Electric cars need to improve. All of those things. And there are policies that can help that happen. But, you know, that's a contest, too. We're sort of in a race to see what's going to happen faster. Will that technological change occur, or will we see carbon emissions continue to rise?
And we're almost out of time here, but also just the demand on power. I mean, no matter where you get your power, the hotter the world gets, or perhaps even more extreme the weather gets, the greater demand on power, I would think.
That's absolutely true. You know, we see here on the East Coast in cities like Philadelphia and New York, when you have those really hot days, you know, you're breaking records now for electricity. And the more people have air conditioning, not just here in the United States, but around the world, when it gets hotter, that increases the electricity. So, I mean, it just shows how really hard this problem is to deal with, because, you know, in so many ways that to adapt to it, we're likely to use more electricity. That puts us in an even deeper hole when it comes to dealing with carbon.
Well, on that note, Brian Walsh, as always, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Time International senior editor, blogger for Time's Ecocentric blog. Also spoke with Aaron O'Neill, reporter for the Newark Star Ledger. And we began our conversation with Lisa Auermuller. She's a marine scientist at Rutgers University's Jacques Cousteau Reserve. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, podcasts, email, archives, satellite radio. Fred Snyder, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder, with Emily Bryant and with Emily Gauze. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.